You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, it all started at a summer party in the Bronx in 1973. Join 1A for a celebration of hip-hop. Jen White shares your stories and favorite tracks, and here's how this cultural force has been shaping what we've been listening to for the last 50 years. That's today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, mourners gathered in Ireland earlier this week to pay their respects to singer and songwriter Sinead O'Connor, who died last month at age 56. That's Sinead O'Connor singing Nothing Compares to You, which topped the Billboard charts in 1990 and remains her biggest hit. The Irish singer had a successful career and an international fan base, but her music was often overshadowed by headline-grabbing controversies, like when she ripped a picture of Pope John Paul II on Saturday Night Live in 1992 to protest abuse in the Catholic Church. As with many artists, Sinead O'Connor leaves behind a complicated legacy, but it's one that's important to talk about and remember, according to our guest today, a music journalist who wrote a book about O'Connor, published earlier this year, just weeks before the singer's passing. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you listen to Sinead O'Connor? What does her music mean to you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Allison McCabe is a music journalist and author of Why Sinead O'Connor Matters. Allison, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me on the show, and thanks to the listeners for joining us.
You were clearly very invested in Sinead O'Connor's life and writing this book, a lot of personal connections there. I want to start off by asking, how did the news of her passing hit you?
Shock. I mean, you know, I was very, very shocked because although, she's had many hardships, she was coming back into the public eye. If anybody out there watches the show Outlander, she did the theme music. She was working on a new album. She was back on social media on the platform formerly known as Twitter. And, it really seemed like she was coming back as she has so many times before. So, yes, it was shocking and also gutting.
I want to talk about her music specifically a little bit, which often, you write, got overshadowed by various controversies. But you write this amazing story, like you see in the movies in some ways, of, hey, this kid's really talented, and somebody hears her and tells somebody else, and then all of a sudden she's an international superstar. There's this huge well of talent at the center of her story. Can you talk about that a little?
I mean, there really is. And I think that gets overlooked a little bit because, you know, a lot of people really only know a very limited number of things about her. You know, they know that her hair was shaved. She had a 1990 mega hit with Nothing Compares to You, which she started at the top of the program. And as you mentioned, 2 years later, she goes on Saturday Night Live and she destroyed a photograph of Pope John Paul II. And after that, she really, for a lot of people, except for people who are sort of super fans, she disappears from the world stage. And, you know, then all we hear from her really after that is nonstop tabloid headlines that have nothing to do with her music. That was really why I became interested in her story. I wanted to go back and figure out how that happened. And I re-examined her interviews and her public statements. But also, as you're talking about here, I went back to her music. And long after she stopped making chart hits, she made gorgeous, amazing music. She's done 10 studio albums in addition to compilations, live albums, songs for films and TV, charity appearances, and so on. She really did have this voice that it was, you know, whether you want to call it innate or use religious terms and call it God-given, her voice really had the power to express an emotional truth. And I think that's what people have responded to over all these years. And that was discovered early on when she was about 13 or 14. She was in a Catholic girls' reform school following her parents' divorce. Her mother had been very abusive to her in her childhood. But at that school, she met a kindly nun who saw that she had this need to express herself and bought her a guitar and arranged for lessons. And really sort of saw her for the first time. I mean, by that, really saw that she had this need, really, to have an emotional outlet, but also that she could maybe be that for other people. And that's what people saw over and over again. And that's why she was signed to her first recording contract when she was only in her teens.
I want to skip ahead to another album here. 1994, the album's Universal Mother. Here's a listen to the song, a song about the Irish famine.
Okay, I want to talk about Ireland. Specifically, I want to talk about the famine, about the fact that there never really was one. There was no famine. See, Irish people were only allowed to eat potatoes. All of the other food, meat, fish, vegetables was shipped out of the country under armed guard to England while the Irish people stopped.
Famine by Sinead O'Connor. And Alison, you know, the president of Ireland was at Sinead O'Connor's funeral, a huge part of Irish culture. As you write, Sinead O'Connor wasn't a singer who happened to be from Ireland. There was something very central about her Irish identity. Can you talk about that and how it shaped her career?
Right. So from very early on, you know, she really wanted to be a protest singer. You know, Nothing Compares to You was kind of an outlier. You know, she saw herself in this great Irish tradition of sort of agitator artists. And then, you know, within the sort of rock music world, you know, her inspirations were really people like Bob Dylan or John Lennon or Bob Marley. The problem she faced was that as a young woman, you know, who this is in the 1980s when she signed her first recording contract, there's just not really an established lane for young female artists to do that. But the Irishness really does come through from the start, and it is a through line in her work. And actually, you know, you mentioned Universal Mother, which is one of my favorite of her albums. It's really not until after 1992, which she says re-railed rather than derailed her career, because it set her back on the path of making music with meaning, that she stopped suppressing her Irish accent. And she goes back to Ireland and she studies this method of singing called bel canto, which isn't about breathing or formal techniques. It's about really using your what's within you, you know, your experiences, your perspectives, your emotions to get to the fullest and truest sense of the music. And that also came out in songs like the one you just played.
Yeah, and I read that she went through that training. It seemed to me like she was already pretty good at doing that, right? Like expressing emotion and her experience through her voice. Came through pretty loud and clear on her first couple albums, right?
Yes, but she was actually encouraged by her label, you know, to suppress her Irish accent because the idea was that wasn't going to sell in America. And to be an international superstar, you had to sell in America. There are also two different album covers for that record, which, by the way, at, you know, again, she's about 20 or 21, just about to turn 21 when that album comes out. She's produced that album by herself. They had another producer on there, and she felt that, you know, that wasn't really her creative vision, so she took over the production herself. But when it came time to release it, they did a photo shoot, and the original album cover, which was released in Europe, you can see this online, her mouth is open in song, and they said, oh, you know, you look too angry for American audiences. Let's try another shot. So that's the one we got, where she's looking downward with her arms crossed in front of her chest.
One thing that kept hitting me through the book is it seemed like Sinead O'Connor had her vision of why she made music, what she was doing, what it did for her, what she was trying to do for the audiences. And then there was this vision of what it meant to be a celebrity at that time, especially a woman celebrity at that time. And they just never meshed. They really, it seems like that was at the center of a lot of what ended up being controversy. Am I reading that right?
Well, absolutely. Because even before, you know, Saturday Night Live, you know, in 1990, this is when she has that big mega hit and this multi-platinum selling album, you know, she's being criticized for really many, many things. I mean, you know, there's an earlier appearance that she was supposed to do in 1990 on Saturday Night Live. And she found out that Andrew Dice Clay was going to host the episode. And both she and the cast member, Nora Dunn, both pulled out of the episode because they objected to his humor, which many consider to be misogynistic and homophobic. And they responded by having an opening skit where Nora Dunn is crushed to death by Sinead's falling amplifier. And Andrew Dice Clay calls her the bald chick. You know, that was 90. Also, a few months later, she's going to play a show in New Jersey at the Garden State Art Center. And it was the custom at that venue to play the national anthem before the show. Two people who were posing as reporters, they weren't actually reporters, sort of baited her by asking her about her feelings about whether or not it should be played. And she expressed her preference that it not be played because I think she was sort of unclear as to what that had to do with the, you know, rock music that she was going to be playing. And they ran with that to a local station. It got reported that she refused to play because she was anti-American and she was censoring the national anthem. So all these things happened before SNL. And when SNL happened, you got the sense that, you know, she had done this thing that was shocking, but really people weren't necessarily talking about why she did it, which was to call attention to the child abuse crisis in the Catholic Church, which actually was real.
Talking to Alison McCabe, music journalist, author of the new book, Why Sinead O'Connor Matters. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you'd like. What are your opinions on Sinead O'Connor? Were you watching all this happen back in the day? Have your feelings changed over the years? And do you just like listening to her music? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. That's Sinead O'Connor singing the Sky Boat song for the title credits of the TV show Outlander. Allison McCabe stays with us, author of the new book, Why Sinead O'Connor Matters. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did Sinead O'Connor matter to you? What do you think is her legacy in music, in politics, in pop culture? Do you have questions for our guest about Sinead O'Connor's music, life, or activism? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Allison, you write about Sinead O'Connor's lifelong struggle with the trauma you mentioned earlier, her abuse as a child. This comes back again and again, seeking therapy in various ways. And it seems, unfortunately, like she never, I don't know how she could, but it seemed like she never escaped that.
Yeah, I mean, again, after Saturday Night Live, she didn't disappear. She kept making music, but we weren't really listening. And she kept trying to talk about issues such as racism and sexism. And, you know, she was early on talking about HIV/AIDS awareness. She was talking about all kinds of social issues, but we were not really listening. And one of those issues, of course, was talking about her lifelong struggles with mental health. And again, we didn't listen. You know, many people wrote her off as crazy and they used her candid disclosures to discredit or invalidate her. And I think that's really tragic.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi, Rob. So I was not a huge, I was born in 79. Grew up in the 80s and 90s. I was never a huge Sinead O'Connor fan. I went to a Catholic church. The priest there was fantastic. But given the totality of everything that has occurred in other portions of the Catholic church, I feel like she's been vindicated and that it's shown her actions, although some might have deemed them rather drastic, that she was calling very loudly attention to an issue which we're still grappling with today. And so I think she was really at the forefront of it. And so therefore, I have much respect for her.
Marcus, thanks a lot for that call. Allison, this is something people are talking a lot about, that Sinead O'Connor was right at the time with her protests against abuse and cover-ups of that abuse in the Catholic Church. It just took the rest of us a long time to catch up with her.
Well, you know, again, I think, you know, she didn't always say things perfectly, right? And the message didn't always land. And, you know, she didn't come on the show and say, hey, this is why I'm tearing the photograph and explain it in very explicit terms. And I think a lot of people just didn't understand what she was trying to do at that moment. And you know, she loved the Catholic Church. You know, remember, when she goes to the school, even though the school was a harsh school, you know, that's where she found her voice. You know, it was the love of this nun, Sister Margaret, you know, who loved her, you know, gave her the love that her mother never gave her, you know, really was a figure like that for her. That's where she really, it's where everything sort of came together. So when she tore up that photograph, she did not mean at all to attack the faith. What she meant to do was call attention to the corruption and the hypocrisy of an institution that was protecting predators and silencing survivors. You know, about 10 years later, a series of articles comes out in the Boston Globe. And, you know, that is a sort of major turning point in the U.S. in terms of public opinion about what was going on. People were suddenly aware, this is real, this is happening. It's not isolated to a few cases, right? But it's global. And it's not, by the way, just the Catholic Church either. You know, people started to see that. And it was reporting. As a journalist, I respect that. I respect the meticulous reporting. But it was also the bravery of those survivors under intense pressure to remain silent, you know, and keep the shame inside, to say something anyhow, you know, to say something, to talk and to be heard. And that's where we start to see change.
Marcus, thanks for that call. And I saw, Allison, quotes from people attending Sinead O'Connor's funeral, some of them abuse survivors themselves, talking about what hearing Sinead O'Connor talk about abuse meant to them. This is something that even if everybody wasn't listening, some people it clearly reached.
It did. And you know, I think over the past, you know, year or 2 years already, this narrative was starting to shift. You know, we started to see this. Of course, you know, her memoir came out in 2021. And that's how I first connected with her. I had an advanced copy of that memoir. I pitched a story to NPR's Morning Edition, a profile about Sinead O'Connor, interviewed her for that. And really, I mean, I love making stories for radio, because what I get to do is I get to have the interview with the principal subject, in this case, Sinead O'Connor. I also brought in outside voices, a musician, a music critic. I got to put her music in there. I got to put some archival tape in there. I got to bring context to her story. But realistically, you have about 5 minutes to do that. It's like a miniature documentary. So I knew even at that time, there was a much bigger story, and that's why I wanted to write the book. So her memoir came out in 2021. And then in 2022, Katherine Ferguson made the documentary Nothing Compares. And then my book came out in May. So this narrative was beginning to shift, you know, already. And now it's really, I think, a positive thing that it's continuing to shift. I just wish that she could have experienced more of that love in her lifetime.
Allison McCabe is with us, author of the new book, Why Sinead O'Connor Matters. So we got another caller. Patrick is with us in Madison. Patrick, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I just wanted to bring up, sorry, I'm in the car. I just wanted to bring up, I interviewed Sinead O'Connor in 1988 in Detroit, Michigan. And that was her first time over in the States. And right away, we were a college radio station. And so we were always looking for artists that, you know, just had a certain voice, certain message. And I was just very impressed by her thoughts about things, her thoughts about the world and things in general. And, you know, for me, I think when she did what she did with the Pope on Saturday Night Live, for me, I was impressed that, you know, she was dealing with fame in a way that she wasn't aware of, and just the backlash of music, the music industry in general. You know, it just shows how relevant she was then and how relevant she is now.
Patrick, thanks for the call. Allison, what do you think?
Well, first of all, Patrick, thank you for seeing it early on. You know, I mean, she really, it was MTV and college and sort of alternative radio in its infancy. That's where she first came to the attention of people in the US and people like Patrick who saw it, you know, that this wasn't just an entertainer, this was an artist. And I think there's a big distinction. You know, what she showed us throughout her career as a musician, throughout her life, was that the real enemy was really our apathy and our indifference and our tendency to isolate and shame people who show us uncomfortable truths. You know, so I think now I don't think of her as a saint. I think of her as a human, as someone who, you know, she doesn't have to be perfect. None of us are perfect. But what set her apart was that she never gave up on the idea that the conversations she tried to spark were worth having.
Thanks for that call, Patrick. Let's listen to another piece from your favorite album, Universal Mother. This is from In This Heart.
This is my grief for you.
Allison, could you talk about that track a little?
You know, I was just listening to it. I mean, even though I've heard it so many times before, it's just so beautiful. It sort of stops you in your tracks. You know, I mean, I think thinking about it now in terms of her legacy, I think that the best way that we can honor that legacy is to, you know, understand, again, that this was a human, that this was an artist, and also that this was somebody who was, you know, committed to talking about issues, especially those that are most difficult for us. I mean, we don't have to agree, but building bridges is better than burning them, and listening is better than silencing.
I've been trying to think of artists that I put in a category with Sinead O'Connor, and my list is zero. Allison, she's such a unique voice. Do you categorize her with anyone else, or does Nothing Compare to her?
I think that's come up a few times when people talked about, you know, the title of that song, and is there anybody who compares to Sinead? I mean, she was a singular talent, but I do think she created many lanes for other artists. I'm thinking about, you know, some of the songs she was expressing pain and anger, and then you see that in artists who came after, like Hole, or, you know, you think about Alanis Morissette in a song like You Ought to Know. You know, she made that lane possible. You know, you're talking about artists who are again, you know, I think that there's a little bit of a double standard in the sense that male artists, it was okay to sort of have an activist orientation. But for female artists, he really made that possible in a way that wasn't possible before so much, right? I mean, people still encounter resistance and that double standard is still there, but she at least sort of charted the path in that sense. But I do think that there really is one Sinead O'Connor, and really nothing does compare.
And just our last few moments, I know the late 80s, early 90s were an abysmal time for to be a woman in the music business. Are things at least a little better because of her and what she went through?
I'd like to think so. I mean, I think they're different. You know, I think that artists today face all kinds of different challenges, regardless of their gender, you know, just because, she came up during what I would call monoculture, when for everybody was watching, let's say, the Grammys, or everybody was watching Saturday Night Live all at the same time on television. You know, now we live in a kind of social media environment where things go by so quickly and things are so ephemeral. You know, whatever statement you're making creatively, politically, in any regard, it's harder to kind of have that stick because there's always the demand for the next, you know?
Allison, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
That's Allison McCabe, music journalist, author of the book Why Sinead O'Connor Matters. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll get the latest on the Wisconsin Republicans who signed a statement saying they were the electors in the 2020 elections and the legal questions surrounding the so-called fake electors in this state and around the country. Plus, it's this week's edition of Food Friday with an expert on marinades. We'll clear up some common mistakes that I've probably made and find out how to make the most of the marinating process tomorrow on Central Time. First, it's always fun to welcome fresh new faces to your workplace. We've had several new producers join us on the Ideas Network in the last couple few months. And just last month, Wisconsin Public Radio's new director had her first day on the job. She comes to us with a long public radio resume, 25 years in media. She spent time next door at Minnesota Public Radio and New Hampshire Public Radio. Most recently was Senior Vice President for Content at Vermont Public. Sarah Ashworth is the new director of WPR. Sarah, welcome to Wisconsin.
Thank you. Thank you for the warm welcome. It's great to be here.
You're not a stranger to the Midwest. How are you settling into Wisconsin?
Oh, good. Good. Yes, I grew up in the Twin Cities in Minnesota. And so I've often, I have loved Wisconsin and traveling through the state often. And we are settling in. We're living near Madison, outside of Madison and Middleton. And I have a daughter and a husband who came with me. And we have had the warmest welcome. The very warmest, you know, gift baskets here from staff of wonderful, like, Wisconsin honey, Wisconsin chocolates, a quilted Wisconsin pillow, just the warmest welcome from our neighbors as well. And I've just felt so happy to be here in Wisconsin and start to settle in and meet people.
And we're taking this opportunity to let you meet the listeners of Wisconsin Public Radio. Kind of introduce yourself. Can you tell us some about your background in public radio?
Sure. Well, I was somebody who did not grow up listening to a lot of public radio, even in a state with Garrison Keillor, a state where Minnesota Public Radio was firmly established in Minnesota. But we listened to WCCO 830 commercial radio often. We watched 60 Minutes. I grew up with a real interest in rigorous journalism, and that's what I wanted to do. So the way I found public radio was through journalism school. I went to school in Missouri, and I was first interested in television journalism, and a news director there recommended I maybe try the public radio station, the kind of journalism I was looking to do, the kind of colleagues I was really, just the mission-driven spirit of many of the people I've met who work in public radio. I found that station. I started reporting there. I became the news director there. I taught some students journalism while I was there, and I thought this is where I'd like to be. And so from there, I've worked at five different public radio stations, mainly in roles that that started out very connected to news and local news in communities. and have worked as an editor, as a reporter, as a producer. I worked in D.C. for a little while on the Diane Rehm Show, which was a call-in program. I love talk show programming and have been a producer in a few different talk programs and love the interaction and spontaneity of live radio that happens here every day. And then I moved sort of into an overall role in content, as you said, in Vermont. And from there, have gotten more interested in larger leadership roles in public media to really just further the mission of public media.
Yeah, it's interesting because a lot of people recommended I do radio and not TV. Never knew what to make of that.
Did you ever ask why?
No, I didn't want to know the answer. Now, what led you to want to come here to Wisconsin and this gig, which is a pretty big thing? We got a lot going on here around
the
state.
You know, when I look at the history, you know, and I know you celebrated over 100 years a few years ago, it is such a marker in the public media system and industry and the reputation and legacy of Wisconsin Public Radio I've known about, and the deep commitment to local communities and local service here is something I just believe deeply in and am excited to be a part of. So that was the big draw. Also, as we talked about, I consider the Midwest home, and it's really nice to be back closer in home. And I took part in a program last year that was called the Public Media Women in Leadership. And it was something that I also started thinking about, what kind of role, what do I want to do in public media? I've done a lot with local news. I'm really on the ground as a reporter, producer, editor. What more would I like to do? And I've thought about a larger role in leading an organization and being part of public media. And so that's how I ended up here. And I'm so happy to be here.
Talking to Sarah Ashworth, the brand new director of Wisconsin Public Radio. I want to get your thoughts on, you know, what you're seeing now that you're here at Wisconsin Public Radio. First of all, on the upside, what do you think WPR does really well? And you don't have to say me. You can say me.
Oh, well, okay. I'll check that off my list. You were top of the list. No, I'm very, we do local programming really, really well here. That I see and I hear from listeners. So just taking our dog for a walk, I've met people who support and listen to Wisconsin Public Radio, and they just talk about the people here, the trust that they have in the news, just how much they appreciate the music that we have as part of our service as well. And the other day I sat in the studio with Stephanie Elkins, and the storytelling she brings to just introducing a piece of music is so unique and so grounded in life here in Wisconsin. And I just think that really very local feeling of here is so important and something that Wisconsin Public Radio does really, really well. The high quality journalism also, the series that's going on this week, How We Got Here, looking at abortion in Wisconsin since 1849. I've been so impressed by the context and the individual stories woven into a history of the state, and have found it so helpful and illuminating in understanding sort of where we are in the state today. So that journalism, that local news, also the technology and engineering that happens here. I don't know if listeners know, I did not know before starting, that you were able to host remotely. People are able to work remotely. That was not happening. So when COVID hit, when the pandemic started, a lot of stations were scrambling. Mm-hmm. Wisconsin Public Radio had the technology in place to work remotely and to have hosts work remotely, to have board operators remote. It's amazing to me. So I think that we are leaders in the industry, too, in our engineering and technology.
Now, every media outlet knows this. We see a different world now. Everybody has a lot of different options for how they can get news and entertainment, not just radio and TV, but all the online stuff and podcasts. What kind of things, and I know you're just a few weeks in here, what kind of things are you looking at when it comes to how we, you know, keep broadcasting, of course, but reach people in those other ways?
We are in a time right now where most of our audience continues to listen to us over the air broadcast, and that is so important because that provides universal access. It shouldn't matter what you can afford, what you can access, where you are in life, where you live in the state. If you can have access to high quality, trusted information and really highly curated music and sources of programming that bring a richness to your life and connect you with the state, that I believe should be universally available. And that broadcast service does that and is so important. But we also know younger people are not buying radios. It's hard to buy a radio in some ways in the store today. So we have to be thinking about how we can reach people on platforms where they are and begin to have more of our work show up prominently in digital spaces where people already are. So we are in a time where we are balancing both. And those numbers will start to change more and more as we have more and more people figure out how to listen to us, to interact with us on digital platforms. So we're in a really distinct period of doing both. To me, that's the big challenge and something I want to be part of helping figure out here at WPR.
And I understand you're getting ready to kick off a tour of bureaus around the state.
Yes,
And you just came from a national conference where a focus was on looking at localism, listening to communities. Can you talk about how important that's going to be for our next couple of few years here at WPR?
I think it is so, so important as we see sort of media companies consolidate and local newspapers no longer be owned locally. You know, we are a place here. The people who are part of WPR, we live and work in your communities. We're here. And that is so important in helping give voice to communities all over the state and connect people across the state. And that's what I think being, you know, that localism means. And that was very much the theme at this conference with a lot of different public media leaders talking about how to have impact in your community and to listen to people in your community and change that relationship. I think for years, you know, we've been a service. We have provided programming. How can we work more with people in communities, listen to people in communities and create something together? I think that's the next thing to really figure out as a public media station.
Sarah, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks again for joining us
today.
Thank
you. Thank you so much for having me.
That's Sarah Ashworth, new director of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talked to her about what she brings to the position and the organization and why she's excited about being here in Wisconsin. Coming up, former Wisconsin Badgers athletes are trying to make the sport of golf more approachable for underrepresented and minority communities. We'll meet the Vibes Golf Club. That's up next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The game of golf can feel unapproachable for people of different backgrounds or cultures. The stereotype of the sport, anyway, is that it's dominated by affluent white men who historically haven't always been welcoming to prospective players that don't fit the country club lifestyle. The famous Masters Golf Tournament at Augusta National, for example, didn't invite its first black competitor until 1975, didn't allow its first black member until 1990, didn't offer membership to women until 2012. A Wisconsin project, including former UW-Madison football players, is trying to expand the game of golf and make it more friendly and accessible for everybody, regardless of their upbringing. Noe Vital is CEO and co-founder of Vibes Golf Club, an amateur golf club he started with 9 former Wisconsin Badgers football players. Noe, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
And Dari Ogunbowale is a co-founder and director of brand and merchandising for Vibes Golf Club, former Wisconsin Badgers running back who now plays for the Houston Texans, joining us from a preseason sidelight, I understand. Dari, thanks for joining us.
No problem. Thanks for having me on.
Noe, can you talk about the origins of Vibes Golf Club?
Yeah, Vibes Golf Club. We launched about 2 years ago in July of 2021. We started putting in the groundwork a little earlier in 2021. The focus for us was really how can we, you know, make this game of golf, a game that we all love and enjoy playing, just more approachable for us, right? Because as a team, some of us weren't even exposed to golf until way like further down, you know, in our lives. Like for me, I didn't pick up a club until I was like 21 years old. And that story rings true for the, you know, most of the guys on our team. And when I moved out to San Diego, post graduating from the University of Wisconsin, I always joked and said I had to pick up a hobby. I was either going to golf or I was going to surf. And I didn't trust the ocean. I don't trust the water. So I picked up a golf club, and that's when I really started getting hooked into the game. But it didn't take long for me to look around and realize that there isn't a lot of people like me or people that have had similar upbringings like me. And, you know, with the Vibes team, right, all 10 of us, we've all been friends since college. We all, you know, joked that a decade ago we were roaming campus together. And we've kind of stuck together since then. And so I had an idea of like, hey, guys, like we have a really unique opportunity in this game that, you know, we're starting to dabble in to really, you know, make it more approachable for people like us, people that look like us, talk like us, and, you know, quite frankly, just vibe like us.
Dari, you were a four sport athlete in high school. You played, of course, for the Badgers. You're now in pro football. What got you into golf and the Vibes Golf Club?
to be honest, I really didn't get into golf until college, like Noah. We had a walk-on in the running back room who golfed a lot in his school time. And I went out with him a couple times, and it was fun. You know, it was fun. We were competing. We were gambling every now and then. You know, it was just something that we could do together away from football. But like Noah said, I mean, I played a lot of sports growing up. My parents made sure I was really exposed to being an athlete, but golf just wasn't even a thought, you know, and that was kind of what I was so excited when I was supposed to start Bob's Golf Club.
And Noe, can you talk about the kinds of things you're doing now to bridge the gap, to bring people into golf maybe earlier than you and Dara got into it?
So our whole approach has been just to be authentic, right? When you kind of dig into the lack of diversity in golf, a lot of times the solution is really focused on access, right? Everyone wants to provide access, and there's great organizations out there that do that. But our stance is you can provide all the access in the world, but if you're not generating demand or growing interest, you're never really going to bring new people in. So our whole focus has been knowing the things that we're interested in, knowing the things that we like and appreciate in everyday life, right? And all the other hobbies that we get into. How can we do that with golf? So for us, it's, you know, through our social media. If you look at our content, it's very specific. It very much feels like it's something that someone who didn't golf but still like similar interests that we're in, they're seeing, and it feels like it's something they should like. And then other things like our events, right? We host tournaments. We've now hosted 4 tournaments. We just did our most recent one back home in Wisconsin. And then we do other events with like First Tee chapters across the country or other organizations like that, where we come to like host some type of golf event with just kids in the area that are like from, you know, similar situations as ours as kids. And then they'll come up to us and be like, wait, you guys golf? Like you really like golf? You're into it? And I'm like, of course we are. And then, but then they see how we play it, right? We're out there just being ourselves. And it's just kind of like a motto for us, right? It's, you know, how can we get someone to walk on a golf course as themselves and walk off of it as themselves as well, right? They don't have to feel they've got to act a certain way or be different. They're just going out there playing, enjoying it, just like they would any other sport.
And Dari, could you talk about working on some of the programs? Oh, you know what? I think we've got the national anthem going on in the background for Dari at the stadium. Let's stick with you for a moment, Noe, till they get through that. What, Noe, has been the reaction when you go to golf courses and say, hey, yeah, we want to do these programs. We want to bring on these kids. Are they open to these ideas?
Some are and some aren't. But the ones that aren't, at first, it's a little confusing to them, right? And you know, and I understand it from their vantage point because they're not used to seeing a group like ours, right? And when they, you know, we always kind of say we're like that proof of concept. We go out there and they look at us and, you know, they're a little, you know, what are these guys doing? Are they taking it serious or not? But when they see us out there competing and respecting the rules of the game, right, and actually enjoying the game for what it is, but with our own style, they realize like, oh, that they're actually just, they really are just golfing. That's awesome. And then from there, right, we kind of broke down that first barrier. Like we're the first one to break down that barrier. And then now we've created kind of that pathway for people to follow behind us, right? And so, you know, I think for me, the reaction that I've had is at first I thought we were going to get a lot of pushback when we started to do this. But honestly, it was like within 6 months, I was on a call with the PGA Tour talking about how there's ways that we could work together. And to me, that was the most shocking. I thought there was going to be resistance, but instead people know that something like this needed to happen. And there's this change that needs to happen in the game. And they just needed someone to kind of help pilot that. And I can't sit here and say we're the only group that's doing this, but we're for sure one of the ones that are really pushing a lot of effort and trying to bring these other groups that are like-minded so that we can actually go truly change this game.
We're talking about Vibes Golf Club, an effort to get people from different communities into the game of golf at an early age. Noe Vital is with us, co-founder and CEO of the group, and Dari Ogunbowale, UW-Madison Badger football alum and also on the team for this group. All right, I think I counted off enough time for that national anthem. Dari, do we still have you with us?
Yep, I'm still here. They all finished up now.
So can you talk about what does it mean for you to get out with, you know, the next generation of golfers, kids who might never have thought about picking up a golf club?
It's huge for me, man, just because, like I said, sports has just meant so much in my life, obviously still being able to play sports. And but growing up, I mean, I didn't even see golf as a sport. Golf as an avenue for me to kind of experience competition, experience things that I get to experience now. And it's fun. It's a fun sport, and it's a great sport to learn. You know, it's a great environment to be in. So it means a lot for me to be able to kind of expose kids to something that I had no chance of doing when I was a young kid growing up in Milwaukee.
And Dari, I got to ask, you've been successful in different sports, as I mentioned. How are you as a golfer?
I'm working on it. Right now, my driving game is probably my weakest point. But that's what I'm trying to get better at. Right now, since I'm in season, I like to use that as an excuse that I'm going to fall behind the rest of the guys on the team. But come off season, I'll pick it back up.
And Noe, if there are people out there listening who are, you know, involved, they run a golf course or affiliated with one, or golfers themselves, are there ways they can help get involved, again, bringing this new generation of golfers on board from different communities?
Honestly, it's just, finding ways to do outreach, right? I think that's one of the big pieces. And just to think and put themselves in the shoes of these individuals, right? I think golf has a lot of anxieties that people don't really consider. But I mean, we know, like I know going into a golf course that the chance of me running into someone like myself is very rare, right? So there's always like this anxious like feeling from parking lot to, you know, to the clubhouse. And if there's ways where these golf courses can just kind of create like that environment where it's like anyone could come play, right? Or even have like open sessions where people could come pick up and just practice putting, practice chipping, right? Because it's getting the club in someone's hand for the first time. So it's like these outreach events just to focus, you know, to get them out there and just to let people know like, hey, we want you guys to come play too. I think for me, unlike other sports, golf was just never really an option, right? And I think if golf courses or others that have, you know, that level of influence to attract people to a golf course, I encourage them to do so because there's a lot of people that want to try it, but they're afraid to raise their hand.
And Dari, if there is a younger version of Dari Ogunbowale out there listening right now, what would you say to them to encourage them to maybe check out golf, even if they'd never thought about it before?
I'd say go and do it, man. Go and do it. There's a lot of different perks to being a golfer as you get older. A lot of people that you get to meet that you, I guess you wouldn't really have the chance to meet just because, like Noe said, it's a great resource to have. And also, I mean, the younger Dari love accessorizing, and golf is one of those ways that you can kind of look cool on the course. You know, have your own personality. So I know younger Dari would love to hear that too.
Noe, just in our last few moments, what are your hopes for the future of Vibes Golf Club?
To just keep it growing, right? To keep growing to keep making an impact in different communities across the country. We've now done events in Wisconsin, Colorado, Ohio. We're just continuing to expand our reach. And for us, what we hope to do the next 2 years is really kind of change the culture of golf in a positive way, or help influence it, right? Like I said, there's others out there that are doing it. So for us to be able to work with these other organizations just to get more people like us out there on the course, that's what we want to do. So, we're on the right path right now. We're year two down. We're starting year three, and we have a lot of plans coming here up in the near future. So we're looking forward to it.
We'll leave it there. Noe, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having us.
And Dari, thanks for being with us, and have a great game tonight.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
That's Dari Ogunbowale, co-founder and director of brand and merchandising for Vibes Golf Club, and former UW Badger running back who now plays for the Houston Texans. And Noe Vital is co-founder and CEO of Vibes Golf Club, also a UW-Madison graduate. They joined us for a look at their amateur golf club and their work to make the sport more approachable for people from diverse backgrounds.